Listening to Horror Nerds at Church, a ridiculously queer podcast where we take a deep dive into a horror film and talk about how it connects to queerness, religion, and theology. I'm Pastor Emily, and I am the double checking of calculations and plans that never happens.
Right? And I am Pace, and I am the flashing of deceased crew members that appear for just a brief moment on screen and cause my stomach to drop the very first time I was watching this movie alone in the dark many years ago.
And I am Brandon. I've been brought on board for any maintenance issues that arise on this ship.
Love it.
You will be quite busy.
Well, listeners, you all are in for a treat. We have a special guest with us, Brandon Grafius, who is an associate professor of biblical studies at Ecumenical Theological Seminary in Detroit, as well as the academic dean. He holds a PhD in Bible, Culture, and Hermeneutics from Chicago Theological Seminary. His most recent book is called Lurking Under the Surface, Horror, Religion, and the Questions That Haunt Us, published by Broadleaf Books in October. Welcome to the show.
Oh, thanks so much for having me on, Pace. I'm really looking forward to this conversation.
Yep, me too. I got the chance to look at the book, and it's just such a great book, and goes along very well with what we talk about on this podcast day in and day out. So do you mind sharing with our listeners a little bit about the book and what prompted it?
Absolutely. So as Pace mentioned, it's called Lurking Under the Surface, Horror, Religion, and the Questions That Haunt Us. I've been an academic. I finished my PhD in 2016. So I've been...
Congratulations.
Well, thank you. Been teaching for a long time. And during my PhD, I started, as I was casting around for what I might work on for my dissertation, I started really looking at the connections between horror and stories in the Bible. I've always been a horror fan. And of course, it's fairly obvious that there's a lot of scary stuff that happens in the Bible. So I started looking at what popped into my head was the Phinehas story of Numbers 25, where one of the priests kills an Israelite man and a Midianite woman who have entered maybe the tent of marriage or maybe the tent of meeting together, some kind of a tent. My dissertation was called Reading Phinehas, Watching Slashers, looking at Phinehas as the boundary patrolling priest in a similar way to the slashers of the 80s films like Halloween and Friday the 13th. I tend to look at those as fundamentally conservative movies that are attempting to reestablish morality and decency and patriarchal control. So I'm kind of reading those as being the same kinds of text. Of course, that's being my dissertation. It's a 200-page book that must have 400 footnotes at least. So not the kind of thing that an average person would want to read. So after I've written a couple of other academic books and have been thinking about how I can bring this conversation to a wider audience and in a way that addresses not only the academic side of my work, but also my walk in life as a person of faith. So I do try to dive into those questions in Lurking Under the Surface, talking about how horror is not only present in religion and religion is present in horror, but how those two conversation partners can really help our life of spirituality. Whether you identify as Christian or something else, I think that horror gives us a way to think through those questions that are so important to us, the same kinds of questions that religion asks.
Real. And I love that the book also comes with a viewing guide. So basically, for those of you at home, you get some fun movies. A lot of them we've actually already covered on the podcast. So you can kind of check in what we say and then listen listen to what we say and read what Brandon says about it. So it's really fun. Yeah. And also, I'm not the best judge of this because I too am an academic, but just from reading it, it was very readable and I think very accessible for.
Oh, thank you. My editor kept pushing me to turn down the academic and turn up the storyteller. And I hope I managed to do that in the book.
Yeah.
That's so full confession. I am not a horror fan, which is a little bit ironic being a co-host of a horror podcast.
Yes.
But I have loved getting, like, dipping my toe slowly and gently into horror on the podcast, and to, like, hear about Pace's love of horror, because that is, like, the main heart of the podcast.
Yeah.
And so when you were, like, talking about it, I was like, oh, that's actually perfect. Like, Horror Nerds at Church, the first two seasons were Friday the 13th and Halloween and franchise based. And so it's like, oh, this is, like, fantastic.
It's familiar territory. Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, fun.
So our listeners will at least be well aware of them.
I can't think of any announcements we have for November. Can you think of anything, Emily?
We will have just, getting into my language skills, we will have just announced the winner of our pet costume contest by the time this comes out, but have not yet finished and closed voting while we're recording. So we cannot say, hey, don't forget, or congratulations too.
Yep.
Just in that difficult liminal space between voting closing and the results being announced. Yes.
Yes. As with many things, voting and counting votes takes time. Be prepared, people.
That's interesting. Funny you should say that. That could be a lesson that might have relevance in other spaces in life, I imagine. Huh.
Especially like this exact week that we are... Like, between when we record
when the episode comes out.
That seems appropriate. We also have our advent calendar coming up. So we are doing, Pace and I are collaborating on, for our Diaconia.Faith collective, we are collaborating on last year we called it Advent Movie Calendar, but it's Advent through Epiphany. So I don't know how we're labeling it this year. But
that is a challenge, yeah.
Yeah. But different, you can watch movies, TV shows, whatever, and we'll have different prompts for each day. Everything from, like, a horror Christmas film to something that features the color pink to Hanukkah to Kwanzaa, like, a whole bunch. So make sure you keep your social medias out for that.
That sounds great.
Watch this space, as they say.
Yes.
Speaking of watch anything, we are just coming out of Halloween weekend as we record this. So did y'all watch anything fun or spooky the past few days or week?
I am always watching fun and spooky stuff. I feel like maybe the best horror movie I've seen from this year is one that's on Shudder right now called The Innocents. Mm. It's a Norwegian horror film. That's set in looks to my eyes like a public housing unit, but I know that might be a little different in Norway, with a group of children who have less supervision than maybe they should. And they begin to realize that they have various psychic powers that somehow work in conjunction with each other, which is merely interesting until they also realize that one of them is a psychopath.
Oh.
It's a lot of fun, and I've been thinking about it ever since I watched it.
Yeah, that is fascinating. Maybe we'll have to watch it. If not this year, then next year for The Slaughter of the Holy Innocents.
It would be very appropriate, yes.
Love it.
I watched Halloween Town, Halloween Town 2, and Halloween Town 3.
That's a lot of Halloween Town.
Yeah, most of those were after Halloween. That I watched them. We watched Coco for our movie commentary for this episode. Nice. And I love Coco.
That's a great one. Yeah,
I started falling asleep during Bed Knobs and Broomsticks. So our household
understandable.
Is going to finish it eventually, but I've never seen the whole thing. So
I love that movie. But yeah, when we do our witch season, we're going to cover that film as well, because it's okay. Such a fun witchy and queer film. I don't know what I've been watching so much. One of my favorite podcasts beyond this one, of course, is Horror Queers, and they each year do a spooky calendar. I've been talking about this for a few weeks now, and so they have like different prompts for October, what to watch. And so there is like one of the, I'm still catching up on it, and one of the most recent prompts was Bad Therapists, of course, that I put on Friday 13th Part 7, The New Blood, with that really awful therapist there. so that's kind of what's most recent in my mind. But I've also been trying to get into Guillermo del Toro's Cabinet of Horrors,
oh, yes.
The TV show. So that one's really exciting and fun.
I thought Autopsy is one of the most perfect television episodes I've seen. Loved that one.
Very much so.
Not for the squeamish. It made me squirm, yeah. And it was delightful. Yeah.
So Emily may not be watching that one anytime soon. We're getting them to the point where they are slowly like able to watch some of the more squeamish ones.
Yeah, I'm not big on body horror. The irony is, like, if it's in person, I'm fine. Like, I was a chaplain at a level one trauma center. Like, I can do gore. But when it's like Freddy's arm, like, when the in Sunshine, when his arm is like the burned person's arm is like coming off, or like that kind of body horror is like horror for me.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, I can see that.
So we asked this question for all of our guests on this show. If you have a real life church horror story, it can be something supernatural, but more frequently it's just church people being together, because that's what we as people tend to do. So you have a story you're willing to share with us?
Oh, sure. That's what we as people tend to do, and especially we as people in community, we tend to do things like that. So what jumps to mind is that for years I've been haunted by this encounter I had at a church I was serving. I was working with a contemporary worship service. We were trying to get some younger people to come into an aging congregation. We've been working really hard for months and having some success. Felt like it was a pretty good service, and we were getting some new faces in, and wasn't huge, but it was a modest success at that point, and I thought with potential for more. So after, as this is happening, I was approached by one of the members of the board of trustees in the middle of the week. And this guy says to me, "Well, Brandon, you know, I'm glad to see the contemporary service is bringing in new people, but I'm concerned that the people it's bringing in are resource drainers, not people who are going to add resources to the church." I had no idea what to say to this, you know, the just the broad labeling of somebody as nothing more than a resource drainer, and that we're dividing people into sheep and resource drainers and resource adders.
And also, what do you mean by resources? Because I'm pretty sure all you mean is money.
I think I know what he means by resources, which I think is different from what I think I mean by resources. One of the things popping to my mind is, have you heard about this Jesus guy that I don't think looks at people in terms of resource drainers or resource adders? If I'm honest, I think that interaction is one of the reasons I'm a professor rather than a pastor. I think, you know, I want to be in a space where I can feel free to argue with somebody who gives me that kind of stuff, not worry about how I have to be polite and restrained, because if I talk back too much, I might never have any of my priorities funded again. And of course, that's an idealized version of academia, that there are all sorts of landmines to navigate and things like that in seminary spaces as well. But it still was a very formative encounter for me, and horrifying.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it's so fascinating to me the ways that comes out. I have never served a congregation that can on its own financially sustain a full-time pastor. That is just never been my experience, for a variety of reasons. Among them, the church is super queerphobic. And like the spaces where ministry happens, and like the ones where like amazing ministry is happening are the ones who don't get stuck. It's not exclusive, and it's like connected to other things, and this is correlation, not causation, right? But that don't get stuck in, we have to have enough resources, we have to have enough of this, enough of that, but are able to like lean into God's abundance.
As opposed to hold on tight and you won't have any, or any number of cheesy things that we maybe should have learned when we're five or six, but spend really our whole lives internalizing and thinking through what it actually means and how to live that.
For real, for real. And now comes the fun part where Pace tries to make an awkward transition, which we have transition music now to cover.
But it's true. It's true. Do we have like music, or do we just have my attempt at transition
music? We have music for all the transitions except for the deep dive, which is Emily's transition.
Nice.
It was not actually music. It was me making up a song on the spot.
I guess I could say, like, speaking of depleting resources, we have this movie Sunshine, where they depleted all the Earth's resources to go into a bomb, but directed by Danny Boyle, who I think many people know from 28 Days Later and Trainspotting and stuff like that.
Slumdog Millionaire. He's just a wide range of stuff.
Yeah. And this came out in 2007. When was the first time you all have seen this movie?
So I first saw it soon after it came out on DVD. So pretty much right. I didn't see it in the theater, but pretty soon after its release. And I honestly didn't know quite what to do with the mashup of genres that it's got. I was completely on board with the philosophical sci-fi, but then it takes this sudden shift into slasher territory for about 15 or 20 minutes at the end. It really is a slasher movie for a few minutes. And then equally abruptly goes back into 2001, A Space Odyssey, existential land. Although I also couldn't help but think of another Kubrick movie, because I was expecting Cillian Murphy to ride on the payload Slim Pickens style into the sun at the end. But at the same time, I've kept coming back to it. And for me, that's the mark of a horror movie that I really love, is one that I keep thinking about, you know, maybe days afterwards, and then keep returning to years later. Think, oh yeah, I remember that one. There are some things that I'm still trying to piece together, or things that I'm trying to sort out. So I've written about it a couple of times. It's got a section in Lurking Under the Surface. For me, it's one of the really great horror movies that helps us really look at what it means to have a conflicted relationship with the divine. One that I think is deeply rooted in the biblical text as well. But probably my favorite memory of it is this past summer, I was watching it with my 14-year-old, was kind of preparing to write my section on it. Near the beginning, Chris Evans, the mechanic character, drops his wrench in the ship's coolant vat. Do you remember this scene? And he quick reaches in to grab it and then pulls his hand out in pain. My kid says, "Hey, look, it's Chekhov's coolant." It was one of those proud dad moments. I was like, man, I'm doing something right here anyway.
Right. Right.
That's fantastic. My first time ever watching it, this is part of our unofficial Horror Nerds at Church drinking game, was for this episode.
Do I say you're welcome or I'm sorry? I'm not sure.
Right? I actually really loved it. Good. I love space movies and like sci-fi fantasy stuff. I definitely loved it from that perspective of like sci-fi, dystopia, what are we doing? The like slasher moments. I was like, okay. Because I was like,
what are we doing?
Like, we are watching this for Horror Nerds at Church. Horror is coming. Horror will happen. When will it happen? And so there's like the little part where they're like moving around Icarus One. And I'm like, is this the point where horror starts to happen? Is that the point? And then we find out that the captain was alive.
I think that moment when I think that's Cillian Murphy who's talking with the the Icarus, the computer, the spaceship AI, and she says, "No, there is a fifth person on the ship." That is just terrifying and fantastic, wonderful.
That was the point where I was like, "Ah, the horror." Oh,
no, I see. Okay, it's not Orson Welles, but we've got a fifth man here.
So I really liked it, and I will probably watch it again. It's a movie that I think my household would like, and this week has been a bit chaotic, and so like finding a time in the future, we will probably all watch it together.
Awesome, yeah. I watched this shortly after it came out. Also, I think I rented on DVD or something like shortly after it came out because I was I was a Danny Boyle fan, and so
I would just like to point out. This is like the first time ever that there's been a horror director who directed another horror movie that I watched before that I haven't watched for this podcast, but I have seen 28 Days Later.
Yeah.
Which is like the randomness of the horror movies. But
well, and then would you call 127 Hours a horror movie?
I don't know that one.
I've read that's what James Franco as a hiker who's fallen down into a chasm and has his leg stuck. I think Don Keatley wrote an argument for that as kind of eco-gothic horror.
Think about it, as we say on this podcast and as some of our merch says, anything can be horror. So
if you want it to be. Or
if somebody else makes it into that.
I watched this on DVD shortly after it came out as well, because of my love for Danny Boyle, and also I love Michelle Yeoh, and I love just such a great cast, especially like early on in the careers, like Chris Evans, mm-hmm. Rose Byrne, and stuff like that, Benedict Wong even. So like I remember being impressed by the cast in the movie. But like you both were saying, when Cillian Murphy says to the Icarus about there's only four crew members, and the Icarus responds, "No, there's a fifth one." Like my blood turned to ice watching this for the first time by myself, like just so freaked out. And it's always been just so effective. And I love the visual aesthetics of the movie, especially like the scenes with the sun and just how like gorgeous that CGI is, especially for a 2007 low budget sci-fi movie. So I this one has always stuck with me, and so when I reached out and you suggested this as one of the films you wanted to cover, I was like, oh my god, yes, we are doing this film. I love this movie so much, I could not wait. So
I almost hesitated to suggest it because I wasn't sure you guys would think of it as horror-y enough, so I'm glad I did and glad you took me up on it.
Last season we covered Twilight and vampires. It was my like we're slowly getting me into horror kind of thing. We did Twilight and we did like other vampire movies that are more horrific or differently horrific.
I find Twilight to be awfully horrific.
But so we're here for the is it horror enough? So our summary, our one sentence summary is, after an initial fail, Earth tries again to jumpstart the sun by sending a giant bomb with some humans who inevitably either sacrifice themselves for humanity or others for their own attempts at self-preservation until a mystery being appears. Dun dun dun. I feel like every one sentence summary I do has a like dun dun dun. I don't want to do spoilers. Which is exactly what we're about to do.
You can't talk about it without doing spoilers. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. So like, kind of my rule when writing Lurking Under the Surface was I was only going to do spoilers for the movies that I mentioned in the previewing recommendations. That covered all the spoilers, and that everything else I was going to stay away from spoilers on. But at some point, the movie is 15 years old, so I'm not sure at like what point does the spoiler run out. It's true. if you don't know by now that Bruce Willis has been dead the whole time, I'm not sure that's my fault.
And we are covering that movie next season.
I was going to say, we're going to watch that next season. And I remember watching that the first time I watched that one. Yeah. Yeah. So in the movie, the sun is dying, and so Earth is getting colder in a like solar winter kind of sense. And Earth has sent one ship, the Icarus One, out to try and jumpstart the sun, and their mission seems to have failed. And so this is following Icarus Two, where Earth has pooled all of the resources left to build another big giant bomb and to send one more attempt to jumpstart the sun. And so we start out with the last messages back to loved ones, and Kappa has this like lovely, if the sun gets brighter someday, you'll know we made it. And as is apparently super common when men are together in closed spaces with lots of stress, there is an excess of manliness that breaks out a couple different times. So
my wife and I refer to this as men solving problems in movies, and we have a theme song that goes along with it and everything like that. So that,
I love it.
Yeah. Yeah. That's fantastic. Men solving problems. Not at all. Yeah. And then right when, after they've like sent their last messages back, they find out, they hear a distress signal that Icarus One, I live on a busy street corner. Lots of people like to.
It sounds like you might have an excess of manliness on your street corner.
So many excesses of manliness on our street. It's ridiculous. Yes. Anyway, so they discover that the Icarus One is sending out a distress signal, which is a mystery because 7 years is a long time to survive on a space station with a crew. So they do the Trey does the calculations, totally forgetting one thing, but doesn't have any support or help to actually like double check anything. And so something happens with like the shield that they're using so that they don't actually like burn to a crisp, and they have to go fix the shield. And while they're doing that, we get our first death. I don't know who it was. There are too many pale white men.
The first step movie. Was not a white man, though. Yeah, it was the captain.
Captain Kaneda, yeah.
Okay. I said pale. I was clear. I was pale, careful on pale. That
okay.
one.
Okay.
That's a little. Yeah, so Captain Kaneda goes out and just kind of embraces that sun in that death. Like, doesn't try and make it back, doesn't try and save himself. And at the same time, all of the plants are killed with like a giant fire, which means all of their O2 supply is like very, they go from having extra to quite possibly not having enough to even make it to the sun. And then they continue on to Icarus One. They make it to Icarus One, and the whole inside is like covered in dust. And we learn the, to some people well-known, to some people not, fact that 80% of dust is dead human skin cells, which I did actually know. And so their choice for protecting themselves from inhalation is not an N95 mask, which is what everybody should still be using because we're still in a pandemic and COVID is going to ramp back up in the wintertime, but in fact, their shirts. Because an excess of manliness, again. A different kind this time, I think. This is fun. I like doing these summaries because I can just, like, insert all of my... So as they're exploring it, they find the crew in the observation deck, which is where they apparently went to die slash were when they died. And while they are exploring, they find ferns that have, like, taken over, and it's amazing, and oh my gosh, oxygen and plants, this will be great. And then someone disconnects the two Icari. I've decided that's how you do the plural of Icarus.
I like it
the Icari. And all of a sudden They're definitely not bringing any of the plants back. And how do they even get back? There is one spacesuit left. And the most obvious answer is Kappa, because Kappa actually knows how to do the things that need to be done. But the second in command was the communications person, and he's the asshole who thinks his life is more important than everybody else when they're on an almost certain death mission.
Yes.
So they're like, dude, no. And he's like, no, yeah. And then finally they come up with a third option, which is Kappa staying in the suit and safest, and then the other two wrapping themselves up in like the protective stuff and praying that they can make the jump across, and then the fourth guy sending them across, and then he goes and sits on the observation deck to die. And poetic justice of poetic justice, of the three that jump across, Kappa makes it, obviously, because he's in the thing. Captain America makes it because he's a superhero, also known as Mace. And Captain Asshole doesn't quite make it and freezes in space, and a chunk of his arm just like breaks off while he's floating away.
That's such a great image.
I do want to say, though, I know we've been saying the last 15 minutes are a slasher movie, but I feel like this is where we really start getting into that theme of slasher, because we have the poetic justice in a death of the guy being an asshole and then him getting the consequences death. So it's like, that already is kind of feeling like we're getting to that territory.
Yes.
Yeah, and I can see
we
that.
We have, when they get to the Icarus one, somebody suggests that they split up, which is the number one indicator that it's a horror movie and that there are white men. White men aren't always the ones that suggest to split up, but most of the time, they are there, there will be a suggestion to split up. I like to think that if it's not because made by the white man, it's because people want to be away from the white man. I don't know. I'm making assumptions.
Cool.
Thanks for being our guest, Brandon.
Oh, this is great. I am seeing the movie in a whole new light already.
Awesome. See, this is what makes it fun to have a horror outsider on the podcast, because they have a whole fresh perspective.
Absolutely.
I try. So when they make it back to the place, they like warm up Mace, and Kappa is fine. And then Kappa's having a little chit chat with Icarus 2 and doing the calculations, and Icarus 2 says, you don't have enough oxygen to make it. And Kappa's like, what? We have enough. I did the calculations. We have enough for four people. And Icarus 2 is like, there are five of you. Ooh. And so Kappa goes to the observation deck to figure out who this fifth mystery being is. And that's when like the filmography of slasherdom, I think, takes effect a lot, where it's like a little bit jiggly. It's hard to you can't quite see clearly who's who and where's where and all those things. That's my theory. I don't know if that's a slasher thing or not. But yeah, so Kappa gets stabbed and somehow doesn't die, and gets to like a place where he can like seclude himself and manually close himself off from mystery scary creature, and then tells Mace, like tries to tell Mace, and Mace has to, the scary creature like turned off Icarus / the computer, and so Mace has to go fix it. And so he goes into does some like polar plunging a couple times to try to fix the stuff. And eventually,
to Chekhov's coolant, just to call back to your kid.
Yes. Polar plunging into Chekhov's coolant. And eventually that kind of kills him, unless it's the fact that his foot got stuck while it was closing that killed him. Unclear, but he dies. Also in there, Corazon finds a ray of hope in a teeny tiny sprout still alive and is immediately killed by Mystery Being with a stabbing. So this mystery being is kind of like a little bit random in the ability to stab successfully, because Kappa lives quite a while after being stabbed. Just saying. And then Mace tells Kappa that he has to manually send the payload into the sun in order to restart it. And so Kappa and the mystery creature kind of have a race to, like, who can control the computer and the stuff in order to send the whole thing, bomb and everything, into the sun in order to jumpstart the sun. And the mystery creature, who turns out to be the captain from Icarus One, who sent the weird, creepy message before, has been, like, talking to the sun for the last 7 years by himself, which is a little creepy. And he doesn't want them to jumpstart the sun. I don't know. That part was a little confusing to me. And then zoom over to somewhere near Sydney, Australia, and the day gets a little bit brighter on Earth, and everyone else is dead.
Yeah, everyone in space is dead. Everyone on Earth is, you know.
All the resource drainers on the spaceship have
right
have gotten their end. Yeah.
Oof. I mean, talk about resource drainers. Earth, have you met the humans? That's like all we do.
We're really good at it, yeah.
Yeah. So that's our summary and our lovely
I love the summary.
Thank you.
Two things I also want to quick add is that just that I mentioned it in my intro, but just that scene with the, like, flashing of the dead crew men and women, like, as soon as they board the Icarus One, like, freaked me out the first time watching it. And I love it. Like, it's just so fun.
Yeah.
You don't know quite you're watching or who those people are. It's really, really unsettling, discombobulating.
Yeah.
Yes, definitely.
I think I would have jumped. So we're keeping track of how many times I jump in movies because I'm a jumpy person. But we're not in movies that are, like, really jump scare movies. So I think I would have jumped if when they were, like, splitting up and they had the suspenseful music and they were looking around, if something had jumped out. Like, if the mystery being had actually, like, jumped out, I totally would have jumped 100%, but they didn't.
But then that movie would have been totally ruined where Kappa is talking with Icarus later. So I appreciated the restraint. I'd much rather have that moment than a jump.
Yeah, I'm a fan. I just was surprised because I think this is the first one where I didn't jump at all.
Oh, interesting.
Cool. I will say I jumped the first time I saw that. But again, I was alone in dark in my apartment, 15 years? I don't want to think about how old this movie is. It's going on 20. It's 18 years old. Jeez. No, it's not. It's I can't 15. Do math.
It's 15.
Math is hard. It's 15, yeah.
I can love count math. I'll math for you.
Yeah, you. Thank you. Please math for me, Emily.
We've already established we should always double check all the calculations. So yes. I'm here for you.
Thank you. Thank you. But 15 years, Jesus. The other thing is I love this reoccurring, we get this through a few things and kind of becomes the weird motivation of Pinbaker, who was the old captain, of this idea that there's something godlike or something that is really, like, drawing people to just embrace the warmth and light of the sun. To the point, like, where the one crew member is, like, obsessively sitting there with it as bright as it can get in the viewing room, to the point as, like, skin is peeling later on in the movie. And then, of course, when we get the reveal to Pinbaker about, like, how destroyed his skin is from doing similar.
Yeah, he said that he's spent the last 7 years talking to God, which is just such an evocative line.
And there's one point towards the end where the sun actually looks like a giant eyeball, like it looks like the iris of an eye and stuff. And I was like, deeply diving diving deeply. You're welcome.
So I think we're, like, already getting to our deep dive a little bit by this. First, want to just shout out your book. I read the portion on this movie, and I love how you connect it to doubt. Are you willing to talk a little bit about that? It's so cool.
Sure. I've got a section or a chapter that's about doubt in religion and doubt in horror movies. And my main thesis is that doubt gets a bad rap. So I try to kind of what you say, salvage the reputation of Doubting Thomas by doing some readings.
I do too.
I have a lot of sympathy for the guy. I think I probably would have been the one trying to ask those questions if I was there. And I
think he's an equal opportunity disbeliever. The other disciples didn't believe Mary either.
Well, the other disciples, I feel like Doubting Thomas wants to understand, and the other disciples are maybe too clueless to even know what's going on to get to the point of formulating questions.
Right.
And so I talk about how I feel like there are several key points, particularly in the Gospel of John, where Thomas is, his doubts serve to spur Jesus on to give a more full explanation of who he is and what he's doing. And without that push from Thomas, maybe Jesus doesn't do that because he feels like, okay, nobody's really listening, nobody's engaged, so I'm not sure why I bother. But now that Thomas is asking the questions and pushing him, now's when he gives these speeches. So I think that's really tremendous. And I was kind of looking at Sunshine through this framework of how doubt can sometimes be productive. Pinbacker is the epitome of somebody who believes he's spoken to God and got a clear message. And the message he got is humanity's done. God is winding down. It's time for us to go gentle into that good night. So I'm going to make sure this mission does not succeed. Pinbacker has no doubt. And we contrast that with many of the crew members at various points. We look at how frequently Kappa is, like, I love that scene where he's trying to do the simulation of what happens after the bomb releases. And then it gets to simulation no longer useful. Probability is dropped below 45%. So he has to wrestle with this. There's this big thing that I just don't know. And I have to be okay with that. And then I think about how Pinbacker got 100% of God. Searle, the psych officer who loves to sit on the observation deck, was able to get up to 3.1% of God. One of my section on Sunshine in the book is called 3.1% of God. That he knows that this is, well, he is aware that this is all that humans can take in. Pinbacker doesn't get that.
Yeah.
I love doubt. When I was in college, one of my religion professors at Luther College, Vonda Diefeldt, had us read The Dynamics of Faith by Paul Tillich.
Paul Tillich, yeah.
Yeah, and Tillich talks about the necessity of doubt in faith. And I always have loved that it, in order for it to actually be faith, there has to be doubt, because if there is no doubt, then it is knowledge or certainty, and that's not actually faith.
And that's not what we have either, is it?
So,
yeah, I talk about Kierkegaard some and the importance he places on doubt as really a productive means of questioning and exploring where we're going, that without doubt, we don't have anything that prods us to learn more or try to understand.
I also have to say, spoken like a true professor, when you were saying Jesus may have felt like nobody was engaged or even paying attention until Thomas interrupted.
It's a feeling that I understand, yes. When I'm lecturing to a sea of black Zoom screens.
Right. Oof. Yeah, teacher online is a whole horror unto itself. I mean, it's a good thing, and I'm glad for it, but like, it is so logistically difficult.
It's tough, and it demands. I mean, we think of it as being easier because you don't have the commute time. You can, it's more convenient, but I think it demands a lot more of the students to be able to maintain your focus and actually take in any of the course material that way. I think it's a lot harder.
And it's a complete redoing. For professors who do it well, it's a complete redoing of a lot of what they've had already planned from years and years of teaching a course and having to like find totally.
So, I guess we've already talked a little bit about what makes this movie kind of horror. There's also the post-apocalyptic element of the state of the earth as it is in this like cold perpetual winter because of the dying of the sun and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And definitely has some similarities in, I would say, pacing and kind of story beats and stuff to a movie like Alien, with the which is clear also like in the ranks of sci-fi horror, where it's kind of trying to solve this mystery of what has happened here, and then some a surprise burst out, whether it is an alien or whether it is Finn Baker. Surprise burst out of this situation.
Yeah.
The other thing I have is, by naming it Icarus, there is, of course, calling to mind the Greek myth of the character of Icarus, who flew too close to the sun and his wings melted and stuff, and he's trying to escape the island of Crete. So, that thing. And so we're doing our BooTube this month, which is what we put up on our Patreon, where we basically do what we do with movies, but we do it about a TV show.
Okay.
And so the one we're doing for this month is Doctor Who, and we're going to cover the story 42, which is very much similar to this, about this the sun and stuff like that. And it was also released in 2007, and the ship in that was called Icarus in the script, but then this movie came out, so they had to change it. So can't quite do that.
I didn't know that either.
So we'll talk a little bit more about that in our Doctor Who episode, but I just thought that was a fun coincidence.
Oh yeah, that's fascinating.
I like the connection to the story of Icarus, and that, like, too close to the sun, because the reality is, like, there's so much that humanity has done that is too close to the edge of something, right? And so it's fascinating to me that this particular post-apocalyptic dystopic story is not actually that humans have done anything wrong. Like, the assumption here is that humans have somehow lasted longer than the sun, which at the rate we're going is laughable.
Seems unlikely. Yeah.
Right. And so then, like, that, the ways that that plays out, like, I love young adult dystopias. They're my favorite genre of book.
And you say you're not a horror fan, but
I know. And I love Advent, and I think that if Advent were a genre of literature, it would be a young adult dystopia. But it's this, like, what is, like, so often in dystopias, there is a recognition of humanity has done something bad. Humanity has harmed. Humanity has caused this great problem. And this is, no, humanity is just trying to save itself and, like, the whole planet and life. And I'm like,
that's really interesting.
I like everything else about it, but, like, I'm stuck there right now. And I hadn't realized it until just now, right? That, like, this is not humanity getting too close to the sun. It is, in fact, humanity not being close enough to the sun. And, like,
Yeah. I think that kind of feeds into the last point I want to that I have on this, which is this theme of theosis, or union with God. And I feel like that's kind of part of it, is that there are various ways they could have went about this with putting a metaphor of theosis in here. But I like how Pin Baker kind of takes it into this desire where he wants to be the last person standing alone with God. So that requires, like, the rest of humanity to die off. And so I feel like the theme here then is, we're trying to, if we're kind of reading it from, like, if we accept this metaphor that the sun is God, then God is abandoning humanity. So how do we get in touch with the divine again? How do we reunite or become united with the divine in some way? So I really love that kind of theosis metaphor, and that's kind of my one of my theological jams. I'm a Reformation scholar, and I'm looking at Martin Luther, and one of the things that I really love about him is this understudied sense of the mystical qualities of Luther, and how he was really into theosis through the happy exchange and the giving of grace unto the believer. Is the kind of erotic sexual relationship for Luther that he calls the marriage.
Is Pin Baker having sex with the sun?
Yes. But that gets to the last scene, though. It's just so beautiful when the bomb finally explodes, which in itself is this really beautiful kind of scene. And then it kind of fades away as the heat of the sun is like absorbing it until all that's left is Kappa and the sun. And yeah. Then he too is absorbed into the sun. And it's just a very beautiful depiction of what I think probably a lot of mystics kind of envisioned when they talk about theosis and being united with the God. So I just kind of really love how that is depicted on screen here.
I love the connections between, whether it's intentional or not, there are so many connections between Pinbacker's encounter with the sun and Moses's encounter with God on Mount Sinai. So Moses goes up to Mount Sinai, receives the Ten Commandments, has a long chat with God. And when he comes down, everybody's afraid of him. The translation we normally have is that his face was shining with God's glory, but the Hebrew doesn't mean shining. It literally means he had horns. There's some corruption in the text, I think. That's why you see all these medieval artwork that depicts Moses with horns after having met God and gotten the Ten Commandments. The argument I find most persuasive, I think William Propp was the first to make it, is that what the Hebrew is really trying to say is that Moses' face was burned, that he was scarred from being in the divine presence, being so close. It was just a few chapters before that when the text talks about Yahweh's glory being like a consuming fire. And so Moses comes down from the mountain and his face is burned. I think the article of Props is called Transfigured or Disfigured.
Interesting.
That you get too close to God and it comes with a cost. We see that over and over through in the Bible, that we have this desire to be near God, but it's also dangerous. And at the very least, you're changed in permanent ways from being too close to God. Often you have something that you have to give up.
Ooh, and that's making me now make a connection too to this like hidden notion of God, which I feel like we get in the view screen rooms with exactly what you're saying, the 3.1% of God, like there has to be some sort of veil there. And so I once again, my Reformation scholar brain thinks of Luther when he talks about how, like, if you lift the veil and see the hidden of God, you would be horrified. So just keep that veil down and focus on Jesus.
It's
kind of Luther's
look at it. Thinking back to that Moses story, there's the point where this is right before he comes down from the mountain. He asks God, "Can I see your face?" And God says, "No, you can't see my face and live. I'll run by you and you can see my backside," is the best he can do. You know, you can see the divine ass, maybe.
God mooning Moses is probably better than the full frontal.
Well, right? But God mooning Moses is enough to burn Moses and cause the scarring, the marks. So Moses got maybe slightly more than 3.1% of God.
He was closer to Pinbaker maybe when he was all melted face. It doesn't say his arm fell off or anything though, so that's good at least.
That's
Moses,
true.
His arm didn't fall. He was still able to lift up a staff, so he was good.
That's fantastic. I, surprising no one, the thing that drew me in for this movie was a lot of the like ways that toxic masculinity and individualism comes out in this. Like, literally, these people are chosen to probably sacrifice their lives in order to try to save the rest of humanity. Right? Like, they are going at it knowing that there's a very slim chance that they will ever come back, if they're even planning on coming back. And so there's this like, there's just like so much of it that you're like, okay, so you pick the people who can do the job, but also you want to pick the people who are not going to be self-preservationists, because that's not what they're there for. And from the start, like, I'm like, okay, this is clearly directed by a man. Like, we need to stop with the sci-fi movies saying mankind. It's wrong. It's old. It's never should have been. Just stop. Humankind, humanity, you have so many options. Pick something else that's not full of misogyny.
And we know all of these options by now. It's not like you're in 1970, whatever, when a lot of people hadn't thought of that yet, or it hadn't really disseminated into the public discourse. We know these. Come on. And we're supposed to think this is 2050, whatever, and we're still saying mankind. Come on.
Right? Like, there's like some, this is only sci-fi if we're still misogynists or something. Yeah. But like, then you get into it, and then it's like the excess of manliness and the fights breaking out between people. And like, I get tensions run high and all that stuff. And they're having to send their last messages way sooner than they thought they would and all of that stuff. But like, y'all have had how long? How long have you been getting closer to the sun and you're still stuck in this excess of manliness breaking out on whatever floor of the spaceship? Also, the like, there's just the individualism, right? Like, it's about me. It's about my ability to talk, send a message back home. It's about my like having to do all of the calculations on my own and not get help from anyone. It's planning to lose two more people. Like, the only way we can do this is if we lose two more people. Who are we gonna, like, literally, it's like, okay, is this where the horror starts? Are you gonna start picking off your crewmates? And the, like, Captain Asshole, I just keep calling him Captain Asshole. Captain Asshole's self-preservation instincts, where he's like, no, I have to go back because I'm the ranking officer, even though we have no communications to send, and that's literally my only job.
I loved that pushback that, yeah, you're a communications officer and we have no communications towers.
Right.
Yeah, but Captain Harvey still is. Yeah. Insistent that somehow he's important, that he's the only one who can keep the morale of the group together or whatever.
And it flows through to Captain Pinbaker, right? Like, mm-hmm. He is the only one who can remain. Yeah. He is the only one maybe worthy enough. He is the only one who is able to remain in the face of God, in the face of the sun, and therefore everybody else has to die.
It almost seems like he's willing to sacrifice the entire human race so that he can be the last man. That he, it doesn't even matter if there's anybody left to memorialize his unique status before God, but he will sacrifice everything to hold on to that. Yeah.
Versus, like, if they succeed, there's a different way that they're actually all going to be memorialized. Icarus 1 and Icarus 2 as the people that gave their lives to save the entire humanity, planet, ecosystem thing.
It seems a much better story to be a part of, doesn't it?
Right.
And that's the space where, like, faith is different. Like, there is the faith of the quote-unquote faith that Captain Pinbaker has of, like, certainty in the sun. But the actual faith is a thing that calls us to be part of something larger than ourselves. And for those of us who are Christian, there's a particular way that we do that, but not everybody's Christian. And it's not required that we do it via Christianity, but that the point of faith is drawing us to something bigger.
That there's that active imagination that takes you beyond yourself. And it has to involve speculation. It has to involve creativity. It has to involve, imagination somehow. It can't be certainty.
Yeah.
I also think, like, anytime we talk about light and dark and bright and dark, we always have to also talk about, particularly as white people, right, that this actually does one of the better jobs of not just having a, like, dark is bad, light is good kind of dynamic, because the sun is literally dangerous and killing them.
Yeah.
Because they are too close to the brightness, to the light of the sun. And so I love that, like, yeah, Pinbaker thinks that the sun is God. And there was, like, has historically throughout humanity been this worship of the sun as the one that provides light and warmth. But also, what if the sun is more like the devil, like, in the microcosm of the two Icarus ships, right? Like, in the grand scheme of the solar system, yes, sun, God, got it. But, like, in the microcosm, they're drawn to it. it literally kills like all of them. And there's this like mesmerizing thing that it does to them.
But that, I mean, that sounds also like the experience that people have of God in the biblical mm-hmm. text, that we're drawn to God, but if you don't do it exactly the right way, it will kill you. You know, think of the two priests in Leviticus 10, Aminadab and I'm blanking on their names, who somehow offered strange fire, offered in the wrong way, to where they get blasted, the divine smite button is pushed. But we're still drawn to this. So I almost wonder if Searle, the psych officer, is almost the ship's priest, that he serves the function of trying to navigate these spaces between the ship and the divine them.
It does seem kind of like
something you said was making me. I was just gonna say something you said was making me think something else, but now I'm losing it. So, well, one thing is, yeah, I definitely want to track this notion of the sun, good or bad, and those kind of questions in our BooTube with the Doctor Who episode 42, because there's some interesting ways that the sun actually has sentience in, they discover in that episode. So not our sun, but like a star has sentience. So like, it's a very interesting episode. So I'm excited to get to that. And so support our Patreon, only $5 a month, and you can access that episode.
Can you think of other horror movies that use brightness so effectively to be terrifying? I can only think of a few.
Midsummer.
That was the one that jumped to mind, yeah. And then Midsummer, of course, makes me think of The Wicker Man and makes me wonder if that kind of does something similar. I mean, Midsummer is just like a big budget remake of The Wicker Man, right?
Definitely. And we plan to actually cover Wicker Man later this season.
So oh, great. I'll have to check. I can't wait to hear what you guys have to say about that one.
Yep. And we're covering the original one. Sorry for all you Nicolas Cage out
there. That's okay. Nicolas Cage is overrated. Us about
the original is where it's at.
Also, but, I've never seen Midsommar either. So starting with the original.
You have an episode on it. Emily, you should go back to season one.
And but then I'd have to watch it. I'm excited for my like experiencing things without all of the context. I think this is a wonderful addition.
I love it. Yep.
I think that's all. That's all I've got for the deep dive.
Awesome. Well, I think we're ready to rate the film then. And we are doing this this is our Nightmare on Elm Street season. Each season we do a franchise kind of as the core. And then we do these like one-off movies that kind of relate to the theme around it. And so we're rating out 10 nightmares. So you can interpret that as you will. and if you have a favorite kill, since it is a horror podcast, we have to get our love for gore in there. And any concluding thoughts you might have. So,
Brendan, do you want
to
go
first? Do I get to go first? All right. Well, I would rate it as an 8 out of 10. There's so much that I admire about it. I feel like the plot machinations towards the end got a little bit silly in some ways. I had a hard time keeping track of who was where. Like, I feel like this was about the fifth time I watched it, and I couldn't quite tell how they got from the ship onto the payload and how all of these things worked. So I feel like it wasn't quite as strong plot-wise at the end, even though I love thematically how it resolves and where it goes. In terms of favorite kills, because I'm so drawn to the theophanic elements of it, you know, the idea of seeing God, the connection between the sun and God and how we experience that, I thought the psych officer Searle's death on the observation deck was really, really brilliant and wonderful.
Agreed.
I don't actually remember Searle's death, so when I rewatch it, I'm going to have to actually pay attention to that. Unless, was Searle one of the exploring parties on Icarus 1?
He was on Icarus 1, okay. And he stayed behind to work the button for everybody.
That
and then
Searle.
As he's stuck on the ship. So he's the same guy at the beginning. We see him exploring the observation room and wanting to experience as much as he can, and then trying to tell everybody about what he experienced and how it's being bathed in all of these things. And so then he's left stranded alone on Icarus 1. So he goes to the observation deck to experience all of the sun.
I was not clear at that point in the movie who everybody was.
Yeah, got it.
So that is why, and that makes more sense. And yeah, that was a good one. I will give it an 8.5 rating. I love outer space and I love outer space movies. And so like automatically it's default 10, but then they use the word mankind. And so we're never going to give a 10 to somebody that can't use proper language to talk about humanity. But I loved the like poking at excess of manliness. And I loved this exploration that we've had of like the sun and the power of the sun and the sun and God and all of, and the divine and all of that stuff. My favorite kill was Captain Asshole. Poetic justice is basically always going to be my favorite kill. and just like his, no, I should be the one because I want to live. And then he is the one that doesn't make it across and just like floats off. Yeah. And then his like arm gets knocked off.
That's a really jarringly visceral moment at that point in the movie. Cause we haven't really seen anything that kind of hits you in the feels in that way yet. And then that close up of his face kind of freezing over after that, it's really, really impactful. Yeah.
Yeah. And I, as we said, did not actually jump. Yeah. What about you, Pace?
I'm going to rate it a 9 out of 10. Fuck it. Because I just, I can't, it's so gorgeous. I can't get past like the visual element of the film and it's just true. Like the food it is. And that also goes to my favorite kill, which is Cillian Murphy. Just how visually beautiful it is for that like final 5 minutes of the film.
Visually beautiful. And I found the score to be really moving at that point too. Like it just, I mean, pushing the line in terms of maudlin and over dramatic, but somehow staying on the right side. Maybe it's just because I was with the movie at that point, but it felt like the music, the score was really, really lifting up what was going on in a powerful way.
I thought you were going to say the original captain of the Icarus too. Mm-hmm. When they were fixing the ship.
No, that's a good one too. Yeah,
but it's each of those are like the like turning and the Searle, right? It's turning and embracing.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
Like you're at a point where like there is literally no hope for you to live.
So
you know you're going to die anyway, and then like, okay, I'm gonna embrace it and like, what do I get to experience of the sun and its magnitude and its power?
Yeah. And how your poetic death, Captain Asshole, is the one person who does get to see the sun.
Great point. Glory
before he freezes over.
Good point.
And then he eventually burns up into a crisp, but like
after he's already frozen. Yeah. So, totally unrelated question. Did either of you stick around through the credits long enough to hear the second end credits song? So the first one, immediately right away, there's that kind of silly, noisy underworld song that I'm not a huge fan of. Yeah. But that I Am Clute song, Avenue of Hope, I had not heard I Am Clute before this movie. I think that album came out like right around the time of Sunshine. And that song is fantastic. And they are a really underrated band. They come out of Manchester, like the same stomping ground as Elbow and the Doves, but somehow they're the band that nobody pays attention to from that town. I think they're really good, and that's the perfect song to end that movie on.
Where can our listeners find you, and do you have anything fun or cool coming up?
So I'm on pretty active on Twitter, on BR Grafius. I thankfully don't have a blue check, so I don't have to worry about whether I'm going to pay $20 a month or try to negotiate with Elon down to $8 so he'll be my friend or whatever. So BR Grafius on Twitter. I try to keep active talking. A lot of it's about horror and what I'm watching and what other people are watching. So I try to engage there. I do have an author website, brandongrafius.com, that you can check out other books that I'm working on. You know, I think I mentioned earlier to you guys that I'm going to be on the Tapestry Show on Canadian Broadcasting Company. Had a great discussion on horror and religion and how these things can work together. I think that should be out right around the same time this podcast comes out. I'm working on a couple of books too. I've an edited volume called The Oxford Handbook of Biblical Monsters. That should be out, and we're still trying to wrangle up the last of the stray authors, so maybe another year to a year and a half.
That sounds fascinating.
I think it'll be a lot of fun. And then I'm writing a book for Oxford University Press that's more academic, but hopefully we'll have some crossover appeal. It's called Concerning Dust and Ashes. I'm kind of using the lens of cosmic horror to look at divine encounters in the Hebrew Bible, but arguing that horror as a response to the divine, because horror is a way that we kind of bypass our rational minds to be able to learn something, that we might reject otherwise. So.
Awesome. And I'll try to get that episode to Tapestry linked in the show notes.
Oh, so that'd be great. Yeah.
And like I said, your recent book, I haven't finished it, but I'm about like 3/4 of the way through. Love it. So listeners, definitely check that out.
Oh, thanks so much.
Our next movie, I forgot to type it in here, but it's it is the final Nightmare on Elm Street movie.
Number six.
Before it gets into Freddy vs. Jason and all that stuff. So this one, Freddy's Dead, The Final Nightmare. We're going to have a special guest, J.R. Lux. They are returning for their second appearance on the podcast, so definitely check that out.
Mm-hmm. Fun.
And that's it for our show. Our theme music was by Matt May. Horror Nerds at Church releases every Thursday. Please comment, rate, and subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. Support us on Patreon and get access to exclusive movie commentary episodes, BooTube episodes like that Doctor Who one I was talking about, and more bonus content by going to patreon.com/horrornerdsatchurch. It's only $5 to sign up, so much cheaper than sending two spaceships into the sun to
reignite it. Good point.
I was going to say, also, we just released on Patreon, and anybody can access it. You don't have to be a Patreon subscriber to access it. But we have a whole bunch of new Zoom backgrounds because Zoom is not going away anytime soon. And while our rooms are, you know, whatever they are, the Zoom backgrounds are fantastic, and I've been using them every day of this conference that I'm currently in.
But yeah, spice up your teaching there. Brandon, with some
Zoom backgrounds. There's one of them, the one that I used today, says "Church is horror." So,
and then really has our little logo on the corner.
I think my Hebrew students might be into that. Yeah.
So, yep, those are available for free for anyone. You do not have to be a Patreon subscriber, but still, it's at that site, patreon.com/horrornerdsatchurch. And then follow us on social media, Facebook and Instagram at Horror Nerds at Church, and Twitter at HNACPOD for all the latest updates about upcoming films, news, and other announcements. Until next time, speaking of excess manliness and resource draining and all that stuff, and also to quote from our season one episode on event horror, if you're a billionaire, stay the fuck on Earth. Or stay the fucking space.
I was going to say, or just go to
one
space.
One or the other is
full
fine.
Full of Icarus.
Yeah.
Just go to the sun.
Right.
You will save everyone on Earth and a whole bunch of resources.
Would it be worth taking Twitter with them as well? I wonder.
See, I don't know, because I have a particularly carefully curated Twitter that I love because I follow people who have different identities of oppression than me. So I don't him to take Twitter. He can leave Twitter behind.
Okay, there's some good, there's some bad. I don't know where I come down on it overall.
Leave it behind and let us leave it behind and let us actually follow the guidelines and the community guidelines and enforce them.
I like that.
Instead of firing everybody.
Love it. Well, anyway, stay the fuck on Earth, stay the fuck in space, whichever. But bye, y'all. Thanks.
Thanks so much.